Last week, we spoke about Abraham and Sarah, Avram and Sarai, or Abraham and Sarah, and the first wife-sister story. Today, we're going to talk about Sarah and Hagar. This is not a clicker that will make it go forward. All right, and of course, I always start with my handy-dandy maps. You'll get used to it as we move along. And we'll have even another map inside, but at this point I think we should all be familiar with the map of the ancient world and really how close everything is and the interactions that are evident because the city-states and the civilizations are so close one to another. So, some background. Genesis chapter 15, verses 1 to 5. Sometime later, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. He said, "Fear not, Abram, I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." But Abram said, "O Lord God, what can you give me, seeing that I shall die childless, and the one in charge of my house is the Messeg Eliezer?" Bizarre statement. Abram said further, "Since you have granted me no offspring, my steward will be my heir." The word of the Lord came to him in reply, "That one shall not be your heir. None but your very own Ishmael shall be your heir." He took him outside and said, "Look toward the heaven, count the stars if you're able to count them." He added, so your offspring shall be. Okay, now we know the story. It's odd that his steward, his butler, is going to be his heir. He doesn't have children. He needs an heir. And it's going to be his steward. That's strange. Now remember last week, but this week and last week really tie in very nicely. Next week a little different. Last week we were talking about the fact that Sarah is Akara. She's the designated mother of the designated child. Abram doesn't know that yet. And the whole lineage gets put into jeopardy when she is brought into Paro's household. That is saved by the fact that Paro is scourged by the Kadosh Baruch Hu, by God, and there is no threat that continues. But now Abram still doesn't have an heir, and he's going to make his butler his heir. All right. It will all be explained as we move along. Okay, so now we get to... this is Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar. I don't know that I would have painted them that way, but it's sort of nice. I like, especially like the little dog. But whatever. Okay, Genesis 16, 1 to 6. Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. We're told this again, but here she's not called Akarat, as she has not borne children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Look, the Lord has kept me from bearing consort with my maid." I like that, consort with my maid, consort with my consort. "Perhaps I shall have a son through her." And Abram heeded Sarah's request. So Sarai, Abram's wife, took her maid, Hagar the Egyptian. But after Abraham dwelt in the land of Canaan 10 years and gave her to her husband Abram as concubine, he cohabited with Hagar and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. And Sarai said to Abram, "The wrong done to me is your fault. I put my maid in your bosom. Now that she sees that she is pregnant, I'm lowered in her esteem. The Lord decide between you and me." And Abram said to Sarai, "Your maid is in your hands. Deal with her as you think right." Then Sarai treated her harshly, and she ran away from her. So there are more pictures. And this one, I particularly like the naked people on the side. It's just this, you know, so Hagar is leaving and Mother Sarah is, in our mind, a terrible lady, right? She gives Abraham Hagar and then she gets all upset and kicks Hagar out, okay? And it's easy for me to see how we in the modern world could understand it that way, and that's the eye that many of us have been taught that story. But again, what we have to do to be true to the text is to look at the text in its context, pun intended. We have to look at the text as a document of its time. We can also look at it as a document for us and how we feel about it, but that's a different study. We can look at it through the eyes of the Mefarshim or the traditional commentaries. That's a different study. But from looking at the text on its own, we have to look at it through its eyes, in its time frame, and with its values and understandings. So now we have another map. Okay, this time, it's a shitty map, I know that. This is so much easier. Right over here. We're talking about this area right here called Nuzi, which, okay, now that can go away, which is in Syria. And a large corpus of texts, of our archival texts, have been found in Nuzi, and they're daily texts to a great extent. They're administrative, but they're daily. They're in their own dialect. Right? They are in a dialect of Akkadian that's called Nuzi, and we have a lot of records of daily life, to the extent that we can figure out how much land cost, how much sheep were worth, because we have all of these records. So that's a Nuzi tablet. And this, I mean, I particularly like this because you can see the obverse, the reverse, and then the sides, because you frequently write on the sides and the edges of the tablets as well. So this tablet transcribes out as this, and this is an adoption tablet, right? And it's the tablet in which Shalwahu, the son of Ibshalahu, adopts Akuya, son of Katiri, right? The Nuzi adoption tablets are formulaic. Adoption was so popular in Nuzi. Dupi Maruti, a tablet of adoption, Shah Techaptila, of Mr. So-and-so Techaptila, Mar Pukisheni, the son of Pukisheni, and it goes on, Ana Ipishu Eteshu, an adoption that they made. You have any number of different types of adoption texts. Okay. You have regular adoptions. Right? Couple doesn't have children, they adopt, or they find a foundling, like Moses, and they adopt. That's part of what I'm going to talk about on, I guess, Friday night. So that's just a teaser to come to whatever that synagogue is on Friday night to talk about the adoption of Moses. Okay. So you have those sorts of adoptions, adoptions of a foundling. They are so common that the legal term for that sort of adoption is found by a well. Because it's so frequent that you would have a foundling, that legal document is called a found by the well document in the ancient world. But that's not what we have here. In Nuzi, as in many other places in the ancient world, including in the Bible, you're not allowed to sell land. Land has to be put down through the family. If you know about the daughters of Zelophehad in Numbers, right? The daughters of Zelophehad in Numbers, the book of Numbers, are allowed to inherit. They go to Moses and they say, hey, what about us? Right? Daddy had no daughters. Right? And Daddy had no sons. Okay, fine. So you're paying attention. Good for you. Daddy had no sons, only has daughters. Can we inherit? Yes, you can inherit, but you have to marry within the tribe. Right, because it all has to stay within that family unit. Okay, that works very nicely until we have a problem with economics and I've got land and I don't have money. But you have money and you want land. So what do? We set up an adoption. And we have what we call a sale adoption. And you're not selling people, right? You're selling land. It's a land transfer. It's a legal fiction. It's a way of getting around the law. So you adopt, right, someone, and then they give you a filial gift, which is money, right? The son is giving the father the filial gift, which is money. And the father is giving the son his inheritance portion, which is the land, right? So you have adopted someone to sell the land. They were brilliant with these sorts of things. So now that's two sorts of adoptions that you have at Newsy. Newsy was filled with adoptions. So the next we take, and this lecture will take questions afterwards. You also have adoptions of grown-ups, adoptions of adults. A couple has no children. They are old. They need to be cared for now, and more specifically, they need to be cared for after they have died. So what do? They adopt. And then that person, like Domestic Eliezer in our text, like the steward, it's usually or frequently a household retainer, will live with them, will care for them, will inherit as long as they take care, as long as the adopted child or adopted adult takes care of the couple in life and in death. Okay, now, what happens when you adopt someone like Domestic Eliezer, and then it turns out that you really can knock up your wife, and you have children? Then the tablets take care of that as well, and there's a different division of the inheritance. Because remember, marriage, adoption, lineage, right, are all for legal reasons within the ancient world. They're for legal reasons and they're for what we might call spiritual reasons, caring reasons. You have to make sure that you care for and propitiate and tend the right ancestors. Okay. So now we have a couple of adoption tablets. A tablet of adoption of Kuzu, son of Karmishi. He has adopted Techeptila, the son of Puchisheni. Techeptila is just absolutely everywhere. Kuzu has given Techeptila 40 homers of fields in the whatever district as his inheritance share. Techeptila, the son of Puchisheni, has adopted, has been adopted by a gazillion, that's a real number, people within Newsy. This guy owned all of Newsy at one point. If a claim is made to vindicate the fields, Kuzu will clear the fields of the claim and give them back to Techeptila. So if there's a lien on it, the father has to clear the lien and Techeptila will still get the land. Techeptila has given Kuzu 1 mina of silver as his gift, his filial gift, in a Pochisheni. Whoever of these two breaks the contract, I don't like this translation, he shall play 2 mina of silver and 2 mina of gold. And then you have the stampings of 15 witnesses and 4 seals, okay? So that's that first type of adoption that I spoke of. There are hundreds, hundreds of these adoption tablets from Newsy. A tablet of adoption belonging to Nashri, the son of somebody else. He adopted Wulu, the son of Puchisheni. As long as Nashri is alive, Wulu shall provide food and clothing. When Nashri dies, Wulu shall become his heir. If Nashri has a son of his own, he shall divide the estate equally with Wulu. But the son of Nashri will take the gods of Nashri, right? Like the Teraphim, right? The household gods. That makes you paterfamilias. I'm mixing my Bible and my Roman, but it makes you the head of the household. However, if Nashri does not have a son of his own, then Wulu shall take the gods of Nashri. Furthermore, he gave his daughter, somebody else, in marriage to Wulu, and if Wulu takes another wife, he shall forfeit the lands and the building of Nashri. So you're adopting, again, this is for prosperity, this is for the physical stuff, this is also for the spiritual stuff. This is for the household gods, the head of the family, making sure that all of this works together and well. Okay, a tablet of adoption belonging to Zigi, the son of Akuya. He has given his son to Shanima and to Shuachili in adoption, and Shuachili has given Shanima one inheritance share of these, his fields and his appurtenances and all his property. If Shuachili has a son, he shall be the elder son, and he shall take a double portion, right? A pishnayim. We use that same terminology in the biblical text. If Shuachili has a son, he will be the elder son. I said that already. And Shanima will be the younger son. He will take a portion to his, according to his share. As long as he lives, Shanima will honor him. When he dies, Shanima will inherit. Gilimu has been given as a wife to Shanima. If Gilimu gives birth, Shanima shall not marry a second wife. If she does not give birth, he will take a woman of the Lulu country for marriage with Shanima, and it is Gilimu who will have control over the children. Okay? And I remember when we read this Nuzi tablet in class, my professor, Zichrono Levracha, said, the women of the Lulu country were considered to be good breeding stock. any sons that are born to Shanima from Gulumu's womb shall be given all the fields, houses, and property. If she does not bear a son, then his daughter by Gilimu will not take one share of the of the fields and the houses. Shuachili shall not adopt another son against Shanima. Okay, so you're beginning to have what's happening with Sarah and Hagar. Okay? You have a woman who can't give birth or isn't giving birth. Now remember, the infertility problem is by definition in the ancient world, the girl's problem. Because through to relatively modern times, the feeling was, it was Harvey who discovered the ovum, right? So, and that's relatively modern times. The entire human is in the sperm. So if a man can ejaculate, there is no problem. The problem has to be with the woman, all right? Because the woman is nothing but the incubator. Apollo has a marvelous speech about that in one of the plays, right? So if the wife can't give birth or can't conceive, right, then she has to get someone for him as a surrogate. We have a whole talk on surrogacy. Okay, so that's what's going on in those texts. Now, this is Hammurabi. Excuse me, I absolutely love the Hammurabi stela. Okay, now the Hammurabi stela is from Babylon. It's about 400 years, give or take, before Nuzi. But again, it's the same concept, right? And it's in Babylon, which is significantly southern to Nuzi, but the idea is to show you what happens cross-culturally. If a man take a wife, and that wife give a maidservant to her husband, and she bear children, if that man set his face to take a concubine, they shall not countenance him, he may not take a concubine. If a man take a wife, and she does not present him with children, and he sets his face to take a concubine, that man may take a concubine and bring her into his house. That concubine shall not rank with his wife. If a man takes a wife, and she gives a maidservant to her husband, and that maidservant bears children, and afterwards would take rank with her mistress because she has borne children, her mistress may not sell her for money, but may reduce her to bondage and count her among the servants. If she has not borne children, her mistress may sell her for money. So what's happening here? What are we seeing? It's the woman's responsibility to provide her husband with heirs. That's her responsibility. Right? And we'll see that again in other stories. We'll see that next week, right? We'll see, you know, we'll see that a lot in the talks that we have over this month together. You need to have an heir. It's the woman's responsibility on some level to make sure that there is an heir. So either she provides the heir, or she gets someone else to provide the heir for him, but it is her child. Right? It's her child. If the surrogate decides that she's equal to her mistress can get rid of her. Her mistress can reduce her to bondage and count her among the maidservants. Her mistress can deal with her as she sees fit. So let's go back now to look again. Doesn't waste paper for me to have put the slide in again and just realized it now. I should have copied the slide and pasted it back in, but I try to save paper evidently, even on PowerPoints. Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Look, the Lord has kept me from bearing, consort with my maid. Perhaps I shall have a son through her. Perhaps I will," I'm going to kill myself on one of these cords. "Perhaps I will be built up through her. I will have a child through her." Whose child is this supposed to be? Sarai and Abram's child through Hagar. Now, we, the reading audience, the hearing audience, the listening audience, the audience of the biblical text, know from five chapters before this, in chapter 11, when we're first introduced to Sarai, that this isn't going to work. We know this in chapter 11, that this isn't going to work, because when we're introduced to Sarai, we are told that she is Akara. Right? Here we're told Abram's wife had not borne him children, had borne him no children. I don't like that grammar structure in English. Right? Had not borne him children. Because if this story starts with her being Akara, then we know what's going to happen. The rest of the story doesn't matter. But we're told from the get-go that she is Akara. So we know that eventually she's going to have a kid. But she doesn't know this. Abraham doesn't know this within the conceit of the story. So she has to get him an heir. So she gets him an heir. She gets him the concubine. She gets him the Egyptian. She gets him Hagar. So that she will be built up, so that she will have a child through Hagar. Because remember, the child is Abraham's. Okay. So Sarai, Abram's wife, took her maid Hagar, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram as a concubine. Now again, concubine, we'll talk about that more. One of the talks is on being a harlot. Concubines in modern understanding are not a positive term. All it is a different form of wife. When you have a polygamous society, you have different types of what we would call marital and husband and wife relationships. And again, this has to do with the inheritance. Right? What does each child get? Where do they come on the lineage tree, so to speak? But this child, even though it's the child of the concubine, isn't the child of the concubine. This child is the child of Sarai, right? And therefore should be okay, except Hagar conceives. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. She became uppity. She ranked with, as in the Hammurabi terminology, she ranked with the primary wife. You don't sell her, you put her back into bondage. You have Nuzi tablets where, again, you're not allowed to do that. once you break this story down into its small components and look at it with the eye of its time, and I don't mean its time, you know, January 14th, 2016, I mean, I don't mean its time to a particular day or place, I mean its time to the ancient understanding, Sarai was fine. She didn't do anything wrong. Hagar stepped out of line. If this were a Greek story, we would say that Hagar acted with hubris. Because hubris is that sort of pride, not, oh, I'm so proud of myself, I did a good job today. It's, no, I have excessive pride that I am equal to my betters. Usually in the Greek stuff, you're equaling yourself to the gods. But what much more of a better is that? Right? But here, Hagar is equaling herself to her mistress, to Sarai. Sarah, whatever we want to call it. Text calls her Sarai at this point. And that is wrong, so she gets cast out. And the casting outifying, I make up words as I go along, is important because what that does is it makes Ishmael Hagar's son, not Sarah's son. She says, Fet, done with you, go away. This is not my child, right? Out, gone. God says, go back, and then we have that, you know, the whole thing going on and, you know, back and forth, right? But that breaks to some extent. Right? The fact that Sarai expected this child to be hers. Okay, so now we're up to the next, you know, set where Abram and Sarai, like this one, you see, here's baby Isaac. Where's baby? Come here. Here's baby Isaac. Here's Ishmael, and here's our pet dog. We must have our pet dog, and nice little curtains. And I don't know what these people are doing in the background. They look like they're sort of dancing. But I just like, I like the picture. She looks like a nun. Doesn't she? She had a wimple and all. But Hagar and Ishmael leave, because Ishmael is now not Sarah's son. But he's still Abraham's son. Okay, I think my next is my last picture. Yes, this is a Chagall. We're not getting up to the Akedat Yitzchak, but it's very hard to find Isaac pictures because there are no Isaac stories. Abraham has three heirs. His first heir, according to the story, is Damesek Eliezer. Right, he's his servant, his steward, will be his heir. His second heir is Ishmael. His third and ultimate heir is the heir that is born by the Akara, by Sarai, by the designated mother. It's very important to remember that the son, the child, is only of the father except for the Akara, because that's when the mother is important as well. The Akara becomes important to the story because this kid has to be 100, what we would consider 100% pure-blooded Abraham and Sarah. Has to be, bless you, has to be, bless you, has to be Abraham's ultimate heir. Now, in the ancient world, in ancient literature, you have any number of what we call succession myths. The succession myths are usually myths of the gods. Which god succeeds from which god comes after which god. Oriyanos, Cronus, Zeus is the one that you're probably most familiar with. You have it in the Enuma Elish in Mesopotamia, you have it in Ugarit, you don't have it in Egypt. right? But you have it in the Near East. Three generations. And it's the third generation, the youngest generation, that ultimately wrests control and becomes the important one. In literature, as in the Bible, you rarely have primogeniture, the rule of the eldest son. You most frequently in literature have what we call ultimogeniture, right? The last, the youngest, or one coming up from the bottom, that the sort of Horatio Alger aspect of it. You have Eliezer, one generation, you have one. You have Ishmael, and you have Isaac. And that designates Isaac, right? The fact that he's the third and that he's the Akharah designates Isaac. But then you have the larger succession within Israelite thought, which is Abraham, Isaac, and you can do it,
Jacob.
Right? And Jacob is the sort of the progenitor of the larger people. Jacob becomes the progenitor of the nation. And that's why we take our name from Jacob. We are not the children of Abraham as we go through the text. We're the children of Jacob, we're the children of Israel as we go through the text. Right? Because each generation needs to play in and in its particular place. So Sarah may have treated Hagar harshly to our eyes, or with rigor, or not in the most loving of way. But within the conceit of the text, within the construct of the text, Sarai did what was right, Hagar did what was wrong, and that brings us to where we need to be, which is with Isaac, because otherwise, Ishmael Taka would have been Abraham's heir, and that wouldn't have worked. If Sarai didn't kick Hagar out, if Hagar hadn't been uppity, then just what she said, I will be built up through her, and that child would have been his heir. But we know from chapter 11 that it has to be the issue of Sarah's womb. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Does Sarai have a surrogate for Ishmael it was Hagar, but for Isaac?
No, for Isaac she bears, according to the text, she bears Isaac. The question was, does Sarai have a surrogate for Isaac?
Even though that would make her child as well as...
No, but Sarai is the one, Sarah, where Sarai's name is changed to Sarah,
okay, but she,
and she
she's,
bears,
she's
old.
120 or whatever.
May God bless and keep them all.
She's 99, so a miracle occurs, and she is able to give birth, which is something she could not have done earlier, or she would not have had Hagar come to be with her. So it is her child. And
that's what the text says.
It tells us that.
And the text, you know, but... Do you know any Gershwin music? It ain't necessarily so. The thing that you're liable to read the Bible, it ain't necessarily. Well, and the best one is Methuselah, right? That's what he said. You know what he says about Methuselah in that song? Methuselah lived 900 years, but who called that living when no gal would give in to a man what's got 900 years? Okay.
I have a question. Sarah was supposed to... We learned earlier Sarah's going to bear the heir.
Yes.
She does. So why is the story interjected in the middle? We don't even need it because she does bear a child.
She does bear a child. Okay. The question is, we're told in the beginning that Sarai is going to be the designated mother of the designated heir. Why do we need all of this in the middle? Because that's on one level, it makes a good story. On another level, you have the whole idea of the promise and the threat to the promise, and then the promise renewed. And that's one of the things that is common in the ancient literature. You have that as a trope within ancient literature. It just works that way.
Did the ancient adoption
tablets
that you went over count contingencies for if a son was born by the primary wife after the deal had been made to adopt the other?
Yes. I think I meant to have given one of those as an example.
Yeah, it was in there.
Right, it's they will get the
double share.
I was going to say the biological. That was the word I was looking for. The biological child of the two parents of the married couple, right, will get a piece. Shine will get a double share.
Yeah,
is the way it normally works out. Right, it doesn't always work that way, but they get some sort of extra share. And there's a contingency if this is the best if. After the couple has died, and they're not taking, and their graves or whatever isn't being taken care of properly, then there's a contingency put in for the stuff to be taken away from them. Now, every text doesn't have absolutely everything in it, because these are, you know, on living documents on some level. The reason that I can do them by rote is because Techatilla, the son of Puchisheni, was adopted by every person in Newsy, and he just bought up absolutely everything, right? And so on that level, you don't even have to look at it; you can just read it because it's just a different name and a different place where the land was.
Yeah, the text seems to be, from your analysis, seems to be fairly clear about how Hagar was her place and how she violated and how it was okay. It's a little bit more slippery about how Ishmael was to be Abraham's son, but then he wasn't. But then in the story, he really was.
Yes, he really is Abraham's son within the story, no question. But he also...
But not for these purposes.
But not for these purposes. And Ben, it's also an interesting... I mean, I didn't give it to you as a choice for text, but I could have. It's interesting to see how the Quran plays off of this story differently. It's marvelous because it's a very, very different, it's a very similar, yet at the same time, a different interpretation of what happens. And the change in which child it is from Isaac to Ishmael doesn't come until very, very late in Islamic thought, which is also very interesting. But the what is necessary within the biblical text is that this child, the designated heir, the Akara, has to be Sarah's, period. That it's Abraham's, that's a given, but it must be Sarah's. There's no question. That's why she's the one that's designated as Akara. And Ishmael closely at the Hebrew word, there is some sexual misbehaving going on, which is why Ishmael gets sent out. Because the word used is also the word that's used with Rebecca and Isaac when they're doing nice little marital stuff.
You saw
that?
Yeah. When the three men or three angels come, and they say to Abraham and Sarah overhears them. You and Sarah are gonna have a child. Sarah laughs.
Yeah.
And immediately after that, there's another wife sister story.
Yeah.
And she doesn't.
Is that where's the question? We're not doing comments.
Yeah.
We're doing questions.
Is that also a threat to the that she doesn't have a child?
Yes. Yes. That's also a threat to what's going on. No question about it.
Yeah. In ancient Rome, which obviously is way, way later than any of this, politicians used to adopt people for political support purposes.
Oh, yeah. Look what happened to Caesar.
He adopts Octavia.
Yes.
And becomes Augustus. And it was a regular kind of thing, and it had more to do with politics than property. And I'm wondering, how do we know that this isn't also part of what's happening in the Sumerian and Akkadian?
Because we get property boundaries.
True. But I mean, they would, when they adopted people for political purposes, they would give them property.
No, but we have, but it's, but we also, there we know, in Rome we know who the rulers were, and that's what was going on with that. In Nuzi, we know who the rulers are, who is in charge, and we know who's rich, and this is property. You can really, I mean, you can really, there, you can really trace, Nuzi is just amazing. You can really, really trace out what's going on in Nuzi, who owns what, when, how much of land is worth, how much, I mean, it's amazing. Nuzi is really, really traced out.
When was the concept of man and wife defined?
What was the concept of man
in
and
history?
Wife?
When was this idea of marriage defined, and who defined it?
Well, it has a different definition in the ancient world than it has in the modern world, right? Because in the modern world, marriage has to do with, at least in our world, a relationship. Marriage is not a relationship, it's a relationship, but it's more a contractual agreement in the ancient world. And so it's four different things. So for example, this is a bizarre way of answering the question, but you're used to my bizarreness at this point, I should hope. A friend of mine's grandfather had 13 wives.
Oh my God.
And 39 children. He didn't sire all of them. But when you were going west in your Conestoga wagons and something happened to the husband, the wife and the children needed to be under the protection of the man. These are obviously the Mormons, right? I can figure that out, they weren't Jews. Right? So he winds up in Utah with 13 wives. I wouldn't call any of those regular marriages, but they are marriages in that context. So again, it's how you're describing it, but from the earliest time, we have these sorts of familial records that would work toward marriage. But even when you think of a ketubah, ketubah is just a legal document of monetary protection. Because that's what you need, right? Because single women, unattached women, are a danger to society because their children are a danger to society.
Yeah, I was wondering, you know, the stories at least that I've seen have included only the ending with the actual man with his actual wife conceiving the heir. In other words, yes, they could have, in the Bible, the biblical stories all end up with...
They all end up where they're supposed to.
Right. So
yes, in the Bible, the stories end up where they're supposed to.
So my question is this showing some kind of disfavor this kind of... inheritance by a person who is not your
The biblical text is, at least this part of the biblical text, the Humash, the stories that I've been pulling from it, are stories, they're narratives. The narratives have a particular trajectory to get to a particular place. At this point in the biblical text, we're ultimately trying to get to Sinai. After we've gotten to Sinai, we need to get to the land. After we've gotten to the land, we need to get to Yerushalayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we need to get to Jerusalem. So there's a point where you have to get in each of the stories. At this point in the story, we're still trying to get to a people and to revelation. And that's where these, so it doesn't have to do with what's in favor or disfavor later on. It has to work toward getting the right people to the right place at the right time, period.
But could the story have ended in the mind of an ancient person with Ishmael actually inherited?
Not if Sarah is labeled as Zachara at the beginning. As soon as Sarah is labeled as Zachara in the beginning, the aged person knows what's happening.
So this is going to mess up that whole story. But what would have happened if Isaac didn't survive the Akedah?
Okay, the same thing would have happened if frogs had wings to Pegasus. Okay, I mean, if you mean you understand, I mean, it's like...
It's a mood issue because
it's, of the story. It's
right. It's predetermined.
It's not that it's predetermined. That's the way it's written. It's not that it's predetermined or not predetermined. It's that the story is written in a particular way to get us to a particular place. You have to also make Isaac the designated one, and there are many ways of making him the designated one. So in one way, he's designated because he's the third. In another way, he's designated because Hagar is no longer carrying the child of Abraham and Sarah. And then another way is in the formulation of words that Abraham says to, that woman. God says to Abraham, which is part of a mythic transfer of kingship within other texts. But that's a discussion for an entirely different night.
With the adoption
tablets. And I think that's my last question, because Ari's saying
that. With the adoption tablets, you gave the precedent for the kicking out of Hagar. Is there a similar precedent? Doesn't Ishmael have a undetermined status? Because is he actually Hagar's property, or was he...
He gets an entire land of his own. He gets a people of his own. He gets an entire, you know, difference that we don't track in the text.
But the model you showed said
you
if Hagar becomes, as you said, uppity, the mistress has the ability of casting her out.
Correct.
She can keep
the son, or she cannot keep the son. She can do whatever she wants. The chances are she can make that son into a servant, right? Rather than a one of the household. Thank you very much.
I get some quick questions. Number one is Tehaptila. What's that son?
Tehaptila?
Yeah, I understand in English that's Trump. just confirm it. So then, also as a lawyer, it's pretty awesome to see that ancient legal. I mean, they were drafting contracts.
Oh my goodness!
What year was that?
About 1450. You give me contracts that are older than that. They're fun.
Crazy. Okay. And then, what's the significance of Hagar having to be Egyptian?
Well, there's the foreshadowing aspect of just like we have in the last week's text.
Right.
There's the foreshadowing of the Abraham going to Egypt and then leaving Egypt, and here is an Israelite giving an Egyptian woman and then kicking out an Egyptian child. So there's a narrative foreshadowing within this story.
And the final question, in other texts or stories, is there any story about some woman who's 100 who gives birth, or is that, I mean, I assume you keep bringing up stories that our stories are based on. Maybe there's something out there, just a question.
There's sort of the miraculous birth stories are out there, and the miraculous birth stories are sort of different in how they are formulated, but that would be a regular part of a miraculous birth story.
Wasn't she 80 and Abraham?
No, she was 90. So with that, thank you for coming out on a Thursday night, and we'll see you this week.